You're listening to Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Today we are very honored and privileged to have as our guest R.J. Miller, who has had a lifetime of achievement as the president of Ford Motor Company, as the dean of Stanford's Graduate School of Business, and as chairman of the Public Policy Institute of California. R.J. also served in the Army and was on the board of many companies over the past half century. In the first part of today's interview, R.J. Miller talked about how and why he came to Stanford University after being the president of Ford Motor Company, why he started the public management program at Stanford's Graduate School of Business, and how he made sure that that program was going to be the best in the country. Later in the interview, R.J. Miller talked about how he helped create the Public Policy Institute of California, why the institute is important, and how it helps the California legislature research many issues like education, campaign finance, healthcare, climate change, and other issues that the state legislature have to deal with. During the interview, R.J. Miller also talked about climate change and his optimism that in the future, some of Stanford's MBA graduates will help find solutions for climate change. Thank you for joining us today. We hope you enjoy today's show, and we would like to thank our guest, R.J. Miller, very much for his time and for this interview. How did you come to Stanford?
Well, I always planned to be a teacher. Pearl Harbor time, I had completed all the academic work for a PhD in economics at the University of California at Berkeley, except completion of the dissertation. By the end of the war, I was a top secret officer in the Pentagon in the Office of Statistical Control. The head of that office was a man called Tex Thornton, and at the end of the war, he and eight other officers offered themselves as a management team to any company that would accept them. Included in the group was Bob McNamara. In October of 1945, Henry Ford Seconds, a picture, appeared on the cover of Life magazine. At that time, his father was dead, his grandfather was senile, and the Navy was releasing Henry Ford Second to become the CEO of the Ford Motor Company, which was family-owned. The company was in a horrible mess at that time. It was even losing money on cost-plus contracts, and that's hard to do. I was intrigued by the situation and told Tex Thornton if he planned to take the group to Ford Motor Company, I would come along. So he sent a telegram to Henry Ford Second. The next day, got a reply, say, come on down. We met shortly after that with Henry Ford Second, and I'll never forget the next hour. At that time, he said, look, I want to hire all 10 of you. Just put your names down, when you can come to work, and how much money you want. While I worked at Ford, I still maintained my academic interests. I lived in Ann Arbor, home of the University of Michigan, and interacted with the university. I also joined the visiting committee of the Harvard Business School, the business school at the Carnegie Mellon Graduate School of Industrial Administration, and I founded the visiting committee at the UCLA, which was my undergraduate major. I also became the first chairman of the Urban Institute established by President Lyndon Johnson in Washington, D.C. for 5 years. The opportunity to get back into academic life came in the spring of 1968 when I got a telephone call from Lee Bach, who was the chairman of the search committee for a new dean at the Stanford Business School. He offered me the job, and I was very pleased because Stanford was a private university, and you can do things in a private university that you could not do in a public one. For example, one of my friends offered a very large sum of preferred stock to the business school under the condition that it would not be sold unless he gave the signal. If I had been at a public university, I would have had to say no. But at Stanford, all I had to do was go to Bob Brown, who was then the chairman of the Board of Trustees, and he said, look, R.J., you take the money. I will honor your pledge not to sell it until the donor gives the signal.
Did you accept the job and come to Stanford right away?
So I said I would come to Stanford under three conditions. First, that they hold the job for 14 months. I want to stay at Ford and frankly pick up some options and make some organizational changes. And secondly, I wanted to maintain my relationship with Ford. I stayed on 12 more years as a member of the board of directors until mandatory retirement, then spent 18 years as a consultant, and retired just 5 years ago at the age of 93. I figured that 63 years are long enough to be on the Ford payroll. My third and last condition was that they establish a public management program in the School of Business.
Why did you insist on a public management program?
In the mid-60s, there was a lot of unrest in the cities, riots in Watts and New York, and in Detroit there was the 12th Street riots, and things got so bad that the business community said, we better get in there and clear this situation up. So the business community established an Economic Development Committee of Detroit, a nonprofit organization. We raised several million dollars. We rented an old factory, and we got the automobile industry to give them some orders, and they were going to go to work to be a success in the inner city. On the contrary, we were a dismal failure. The blacks that we tried to put into management didn't really know how to manage, and it turned out that the white people also did not know how to operate a nonprofit organization in a political environment. We knew in business how to make what I call private goods at a profit. We could sell all the cars and radios and cell phones as long as there was a demand. And this is an important statement. All of the big problems are in the public sector: unemployment, health, education, welfare, wars, nuclear threats, climate change, budget deficits at the public, at the federal, state, and local level. In my opinion, no place was doing the proper training, research, and teaching in these fields. And I said I thought the best place to do it would be in the business schools. And so I would take the job only on the condition that they start a public management program in the business schools. In addition to training some people to go directly into the public sector, this program, added, would have a second goal. That would be that all students would get a better understanding and exposure to public policy programs so that they could support them at the ballot box and so forth.
You came to Stanford in 1969, and 5 years later, the deans of the biggest business schools in the country voted Stanford's business school program number one. How did that happen?
Success at any organization depends upon the people that you could hire. I wanted to get the very best ones I could, especially to be the director of the new public management program. I asked Bob McNamara, my close friend, for advice, and he said one of the smartest guys he knew was Alan Intolman, a Rhodes Scholar, PhD from MIT, and was assistant secretary of the planning department. At that time, he was working at Litton Industries as charge of the medical division, which was another plus as far as I was concerned. While I was at Ford, the most expensive item in the cost of a car was the cost of health insurance. It even exceeded the cost of steel. And I wanted someone that could research and teach in this area. So I offered Alan Intolman the job. He turned me down because he had some options very valuable at Litton Industries. But he tipped me off. He said, look, I think you could hire my fellow Rhodes Scholar person, Harry Rowan, who was then the president of the RAND Corporation. Wow, I thought, Harry Rowan, a great reputation. Alan was right. I hired Rowan. He became director of the public management program. He is still at Stanford, had a distinguished career over the past 40 years. At that time, again, in 1979, I knew George Shultz was quitting as dean of the Chicago Business School, and tried to hire him, but he decided to accept a job in Washington, D.C., and had a brilliant record there. But when he finally decided to leave government to become the president of Bechtel Industries, I was able to hire him as a 25% tenured professor, which meant that he could live on Stanford campus and interact with the students. Other reasons were present for our success. I had a first-rate faculty that was supportive across the board. I got a lot of financial support from the business community, and the public seemed to like the goals we set up for diversification within the business school.
Could you give us an example of these goals?
When I came out to the school first in 1969, there were only 5 blacks in the school. They increased that to 26 by the time I left. The number of women went from 10 to 146, and believe it or not, there had been no Latinos in the school at all, so it went from 0 to 24. But I want to emphasize the last point. The halo effect of Stanford name was when we were able to build up the reputation of the school so quickly. I can indicate that by the experience I had at Kent School. I was a trustee there, and the trustees of the school evaluate the headmaster in large part upon where he gets his graduates into the Ivy League. And sure enough, on the trustee meeting at graduation, he listed all the 8 schools of the Ivy League. But before he reached the total, he added Stanford. Then they crossed the line. It meant to be a great deal if the Eastern establishment was able to put Stanford in the same class as Harvard and Yale. That meant that it was a good place to establish the reputation of a business school as well.
Can the great reputation of Stanford's Graduate School of Business be maintained?
Yes, I think it can only be maintained, but even increased. Garth Salona, the dean, is a great, successful person. He has strong faculty support. He's a great fundraiser. He built that beautiful Stanford campus. The interaction among the business school and the other schools at Stanford is very high indeed. There's one area that I think is an outstanding job will soon be done. I'm talking about the admissions process. Stanford is by far the most selective business school to get into. And when I was dean, I never thought we knew exactly which persons to admit. I tried to get some professors interested in making a study of it, but was not successful. But in having lunch with Dean Salona and Jim Van Horn, I mentioned this fact. And within a few weeks, Garth Salona came back and said, I've got a couple of professors that are willing to study this problem. And they're now working on a multi-year program to determine what factors really should be evaluated in admitting people to the school. They want to admit individuals who are interested not only in a business career, but also become leaders in the nonprofit sector. So I think in doing the work, they will not only look at what the student does after he graduates, but also evaluate the careers of the ones that were not admitted. Warren Buffett applied to Harvard. They turned him down. He went to Columbia. We don't want to miss any Warren Buffetts in the future. I think that the broader concept of management in the business school will attract even more students than been true in the past.
What do you mean by that?
In 1977, the U.S. government made an attempt to break up IBM. I was recognized by the New York Court as a management expert, and I thought if I was going to testify, I should come up with my own definition of what I meant by management. I define management as a 5-step process. The first step is to set your objective. What is it you're trying to achieve? In business, it's easy. If you ask any businessman what's your number one goal, he will say profits. That's harder for a nonprofit executive to answer. For example, what's the objective of Stanford? I'm not speaking for President Hennessy, but among other things that a university aims for are good jobs, better citizens, how to lead a better life, and doing first-rate research. The second step in the management process is to state your plan. How are you going to achieve your objective? And then you have to do it. How do you actually, this most of the time is spent in actually trying to execute the plan. And while you're doing that, you also need to, as the fourth step, evaluate how you're doing. What good a job are we doing achieving the objective? And you'll find out after analysis you'll need some corrective action. So then you take corrective action. And those 5 steps might indicate what we mean by the broader concept of management. At Stanford, they have started a Center for Social Innovation, works on these problems. Also, there's going to be a new course taught next year on philanthropy. It will be joint taught by Paul Brest, former dean of the Stanford Law School and more recently retired chairman of the Hewlett Foundation, and Mark Wilson, a professor at Stanford, who is also the CEO of a wealth management firm established by Bob Bass. Bob Bass, one of his students at Stanford. There are a lot of answers that need to be made in these fields, and I can think of no better place to work on them than the Stanford University. ¶¶
Are you worried about the reduction of government support for education and research?
Yes, I am. At UCLA, when I attended as an undergraduate, tuition did not exist. You paid $32, I think, for the health insurance. Now the cost is over $12,000. I simply could not be able to afford that at the time. In addition, thousands of people are turned down by junior colleges. In my day, all you had to do was show up with a high school diploma to be admitted. Even after admission, many of the students in 2 and 4 year institutions cannot graduate in the required number of time because the financial restraints has reduced the number of courses added each year. Not only do the schools need more money, but we must spend a lot more money in other areas, such as the infrastructure, schools, bridges are falling down, other areas need more revenue. I believe a very large part of the increase in revenue can be collected by closing loopholes in our current tax structure and reducing the costs in many areas, particularly in the health coverage field. We are spending several times what other nations are spending on health and are not getting better results.
What are some of your thoughts about the future?
Well, I'm moderately optimistic. One big long-term worry is climate change, but more people are beginning to recognize it's caused by human beings and are willing to take action to improve it. Even Al Gore, who's been ringing the alarm bell for a long time, is getting more optimistic. I read in today's paper that the Supreme Court has upheld the EPA regulations to control carbon emitted by coal plants, and even former Secretary Ed Paulson had an editorial in last Sunday's New York Times saying the business community should get behind a charge on carbon emission. And today, in the paper, he was at George Shultz, was worried to the point he'd put on panels on his house and was driving an electric car. Every year I meet with graduates of the Business School Public Management Program. I come away impressed of their idealism and their eagerness to make this a better world in which to live. And I'm glad to report that more support, for example, is coming from Silicon Valley. Two of them told me, for example, that they are going to work for a new nonprofit organization funded by Steve Jobs' widow, Laureen, who is an MBA graduate. So Silicon Valley, working with Stanford University, can accomplish a great deal and make this a better world in which to live.
What is the most recent book that you read about climate change?
I just finished reading the book by Elizabeth Colbert on the sixth extinction. She points out how there have been 5 extinctions during the world, and the reason they happen is because things change, and the species can't keep up with the change. And at the present time, what's happening, for example, there's more carbon dioxide in the air, basically, and the temperatures have been going up, and ice melting. But the cause of the carbon dioxide is because burning all these fossil fuels. And she says, ironically, that for the first time in history, the species knows what causes an extinction, but we're not doing enough about it. We're just putting our foot on the gas instead of the brake. That's why it's just beginning to change. You know, I mentioned some ideas, and I hope it does, because otherwise the sea is going to rise. There's going to be millions of people trying to move. With other problems, so having that on top is something that we ought to try to recognize.
What do you think are the most important decisions that were made so far about climate change?
I think that one of the most important decisions in history was in December 2002 when the Supreme Court chose, in effect, Bush over Gore to be the president, because Gore had written books on this subject, and then after he got out, he made the film, he recognized it. And the U.S. was one of the countries that did not approve the Kyoto treatment about world control of pollutants in the air. But we would, I think, ratified it, we'd have been a leader.
You're listening to KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. We are very honored and privileged that our guest today is R.J. Miller, former president of Ford Motor Company, former dean of Stanford's Graduate School of Business, and former chairman of the Public Policy Institute of California. In this section, R.J. will tell us how and why he started the Public Policy Institute of California.
I was on the UNIT Foundation, and Roger Hines was the chairman of the Hewlett Foundation. And there were a lot of problems, and I was a board member. And he was a very close friend of mine. I knew him in Ann Arbor when I lived in Ann Arbor, and he was in the administration of the University of Michigan. And his idea, basically, that there, not enough research was doing on California problems. California is the leading state, leads the nation in climate control in lots of areas. And they lack the money to do enough research in these fields. We were talking earlier about there's a lack of money for research, but even California, which is more generous and well off than most states, was short. So Roger and I worked on Bill Hewlett, and he came up with $120 million to fund the Public Policy Institute of California in 1974. And the purpose of the Public Policy Institute of California with $120 million endowment was not to publish books. Our objective was to influence legislation in Sacramento. We've only published a couple of books, but we come out with information all the time on every problem you could have in California, be it education or pollution. We've been very influential. We thought we might build the institute in Sacramento, but it turned out better. We built it right here at 500 Bonner Building in San Francisco. And it found out it was easier for the warring factions in Sacramento to come to San Francisco, where they could be on neutral ground. And Steve Bechtel gave us a couple $1 billion to have a conference center at the bottom of the building. And it has a very fine, objective reputation that is doing a real good job.
Does the Public Policy Institute of California take positions on issues?
It's an objective organization. They simply come out with the facts, pro and con. They do not take a position on any political issue. We're recognized as being very objective, but that's a nice reputation, and we're going to maintain it.
Campaign finance reform is something that you've been interested in for a long time. What do you think of campaign finance today?
I was a strong advocate of the campaign finance laws that McCain advocated back 15, 20 years ago. They were enacted, and one of the supporters was a close friend of mine, Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett and I are both from Nebraskans. One time, when Warren was here sitting on the couch, the cell phone rang, and he said, "That must be the former governor of Nebraska." Warren said, "Look, we want to be sure that Senator Nelson from Nebraska votes to support McCain and his campaign finance, because they thought it was terribly important." And he said, "If he doesn't, why, we'll buy a full-page ad. We'll put it in every newspaper in Nebraska, saying that's what Nelson ought to do." Well, they passed the campaign finance laws, but unfortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court has gutted those laws. That Citizens case, where they say dollars are the same thing as free speech, is wrong. It's not the same as free speech. You can't put a corporation in jail. And then, more recently, they almost eliminated the ceiling that you could put on in the McCutcheon case. So I think the fact that unlimited money can be spent on campaigns is a real curse. It has led to gridlock in Congress because it costs so much money now to get elected. Once you're elected, they start worrying about raising money again. The money is so much important. Citizens are participating less in government. For example, Cantor was voted out by only 12% vote. We have to turn. I would like to see a constitutional amendment that would override what the Supreme Court has done in the campaign finance area. I think the solution has to be public financing of campaigns. The person can't spend any more money, including his own money, except what he raises through the public. And I think that would get the public more interested in it. There would be the lobbyist influence would be cut way back. But the influence of lobbyists on campaigns now is entirely too excessive. I think it threatens our democratic process. So, ordinarily, as I said earlier, I'm basically an optimist, but I'm real discouraged about what's happened to the limits on campaign financing. I hope we can get that turned around soon.
How do you think public financing of campaigns would work?
It used to be you could mark off a box. You kick in $1 to $5, I forgot, on your tax returns to supply public funding. And then the dollars that come from that, it wouldn't take a lot of dollars if you weren't. All this money spent on advertising and negative advertising, if they just got out and had debates like Lincoln and Douglas did, that didn't cost much money, where you could talk about the real problems, it wouldn't cost a lot of money. So it would be public financing. It would be if Hillary was to run for president, she would try to get individuals to give $5, $10, or $20, whatever it was. There would be a limit on how much she could raise and spend, and some of it would come from the directly from the tax policy. It'd be very modest. I mean, when I say public financing, I guess I meant complete public financing. I would allow low limits on just a few $100,000 or something like that, but nothing like these tens of millions of dollars that are spent. You know, millions will be spent on this next election. It's a waste of money.
You mentioned that before we change a policy, we need to get the facts out to the public. What do you think the media's role is in getting the facts out?
I was on the Washington Post board for 19 years. I enjoyed it. And they try, New York Times tries, but they don't always get it right. They're very helpful. And I think on balance, are a force for the good. But take the Iraq War, which was a great mistake going into Iraq. We just didn't have, nobody had the facts. Some people questioned the war, as we know, as how Obama basically got elected. But there is so much advantage in getting your own point of view across that money buys the influence to get their point of view accepted by the general public. And furthermore, there are a lot of facts we really don't know. I mentioned all the problems in the public sector, like what should we do on education? To what extent should it be split between the public and the private? We really don't know. There are tests are going forward with charter schools, but we still don't know the correct facts on lots of things. I was trained as an economist, and we don't know the facts of what causes depression. People that forecast, they forecast often because they're usually wrong. And furthermore, conditions change through time. What makes the stock market goes up and down? Stocks go down 20% in the day. They're not worth 20% less money than the day before. It's not an easy world. So more attention should be put on trying to actually get and dispense the facts. But at the same time, they're fighting another vested interest that doesn't want the facts to be known. That's why you need a place like Stanford to be objective and forecast and support the right policies and the right answers.
Does Stanford's Graduate School of Business publish books on public management and policy issues?
Only one book published. They had never published a book, and I told you that I was on the Utah International Board and knew Mariner Eccles, and he had a brilliant career. He only went through grade school, but he was an outstanding Federal Reserve chairman, and in 1933 and 35, he was responsible for passing the Banking Act of those days. And my own field was in economics, especially in banking and finance. And in 1968, I said I would come to Stanford if they held the job for 14 months. And during that 14 months, I attended a session that Nelson Rockefeller had in New York out of Crotonville, and Mariner Eccles was there. So I went up to him and introduced myself. And I said, I knew his fellow Mormon, George Romney, the father of Milt Romney, was the governor of Michigan, and we talked about him and so forth, and we hit it off, and I say, I did go on his board. And then he authorized a book, an autobiography, and he wanted it published, and he wanted it published by the Stanford Press. And I went to the Stanford Press, and they had all kinds of red tape. You had to have it reviewed by a committee and so forth, and he was in a hurry to get it out. So I found out anybody could publish a book. So I got Lee Bach, who was an outstanding professor at Stanford, to write the preface. He'd been an advisor to the Federal Reserve Board, so he knew Mariner. He wrote the preface, and we got the book published in a hurry. That's the only book that the Stanford Business School has published, the only book published while I was there. And you may have noticed the picture. There's a painting of me in the business school, and I'm holding a book in my hand. It's this autobiography of Mariner Eccles.
Do you think the public would benefit if Stanford's Graduate School of Business started publishing books on different management and policy issues?
The professors write a lot of books, but the business school, they have their own publishers. Well, Stanford has a very, that's the way you gain your reputation in school, is you plant books. But you asked about the business school publishing the books. The business school, per se, I think just published one book. This was a book by a non-professor, of course. But no, they're... Oh, Jim Van Horn is a very well-known publisher. As a matter of fact, when Garth Soloder, the current dean, was in South Africa, he took an undergraduate course using Professor Jim Van Horn's book that encouraged him to come to Stanford, where he got his PhD, and now he's doing this great job as a dean himself. But Lee Bach wrote an economics book that was widely accepted.
Do you think online classes can help reduce the cost of education?
The cost of going to education is too high. That's a real big problem now. I was pleased John Hennessy said he was going to take some time off and really learn how to reduce the cost of education by using the online. I think Stanford's a leader in that. The trick is to get it going without losing the personal touch and how to have the interaction, student and professor. There are a lot of tough problems, but Stanford is the leader in almost all of them.
How do you think Stanford's graduates are changing the world today?
Well, I think it's just amazing how this new industrial revolution has happened at Stanford. It goes back to the Terman that got Dave Packard and Bill Hewlett together, and then Steve Jobs and the other co-founder started from there, that it feeds on itself. Now, if you want to start a new company, this is the place to do it because you can draw on all this accumulated talent. And I think it's had obviously impact worldwide, and it's, I think, all for the good.
How do you think Stanford's graduates are changing philanthropy today?
The entrepreneurs of Silicon Valley, in their approach to philanthropy, have seen it as something more than just leaving the money on the stump and let the recipient spend it any way it wants without a follow-up. I've talked to a number of them. And instead of that, they get interested in how the recipient actually carries through to see if they do what they say they're going to do, and they give them help in achieving their particular goals. And I think more of them, as they grow older and made their money, they're willing to get more involved in the public policy issue. An illustration that I like to think most about was Tom Sawyer. He got an MBA from Stanford several years ago. He's a billionaire. Now he sold his hedge fund, and he's working on climate change. He's working in the public policy area because he carried over the things that he learned when he was in business school, was infected by this broader concept of management where you need to think about the broader implications instead of just making a profit. And I think more of that, and that's happening here in Stanford, and I think we'll see more of that, where the philanthropy will grow into a more directed philanthropy, more directed attack on these public management problems that we have across the way. For example, the nuclear threat, there's Ralph at Stanford working on that, and Harry Rowan, he was an expert in these fields. That Stanford has got a tremendous resource base. It is actually, its reputation is going up so much now, they call Harvard and Stanford of the East. We deserve that reputation.
The last question for R.J. Miller, who has had a lifetime of achievement and has celebrated his 98th birthday this year, was whether work or family was more important.
Your job's important, but your family's more important. You quit your job at some time in your life, but you never quit your family. Your family grows and your other friends die. If you live to be 98, most of the ones you really know real well are gone, but you're lucky to have a happy family life.
Thank you for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. We would like to thank our guest, R.J. Miller, very, very much for his time and for this interview. If you would like a copy of this interview, please download it from our website, moderntechnews.com. That's moderntechnews.com. ¶¶